Comics. Comics. Today we're going to be talking about the sword and sorcery hero Conan the Barbarian, also known as Conan the Cimmerian, created by Robert E. Howard under very odd circumstances in 1932 for a pulp title called Weird Tales Magazines. But I'll get into that in a minute. Conan the Barbarian has been adapted into books, comics, films, including Conan the Barbarian in 1982 and 2011, Conan the Destroyer, and in Red Sonja, but under a different name. The stories have also been adapted into television programs, animated and live action, video games, and role-playing games. We're going to be talking about the books and the comics as well as the films. But before we do, is there anything you wanted to say before we get started, Steve?
Sure. Between the time when the oceans drank Atlantis and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of, and unto this Conan, wearing the jewel crown of Aquilonia upon a troubled brow. And it is I, your co-host, who can tell thee of his saga. And yes, we will likely talk about where that quote came from later, because that's a story in itself. Conan is a character that I grew to love over time, even if I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of his out the gate. I enjoyed the Conan films back when they came out. I mean, don't get me wrong. They were really fun fantasy films at a time before good fantasy films were all that common. The fact that I can quote that Mako introduction almost verbatim should tell you how much I adored the Arnold films. But it was later, once I became steeped in swords and sorcery and heroic fantasy, that I really got into Conan of Cimmeria and realized why he was such an iconic and beloved character. I'll also add that Conan is that rare fantasy hero who is equally iconic in comics as well as in novels and films. I don't know any other classic fantasy hero from literature who's crossed those genres as well or as successfully. The closest I can think of is Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné, who I may bring up later, along with maybe Geralt of Rivia or Dristo Urden. But Conan stands heads and above all of them, and even over characters I honestly have more affection for. That's not a small achievement. He also inspired the creation of Red Sonja, who's the classic chicken chainmail heroine, but we'll discuss her later as well, as she spun off from both Robert Howard's short stories and the Conan comics.
I can't wait to talk about that, actually. I was a huge Red Sonja fan as a kid, and of Conan as well, so that should be fun. But on to the first film, Conan the Barbarian. According to the Making of Conan the Barbarian doc, also called Conan Unchained, Howard is described by Oliver Stone, who wrote the first script of Conan the Barbarian, as a strange bird from Texas who wrote great stories. John Milius, the eventual writer for the script of Conan the Barbarian movie, says that Howard believed his hometown wanted to exterminate him, and that so he went home and boarded up his windows and loaded up his rifles like a complete nut. That's a quote from Milius, by the way. I just want to comment on the callousness of Stone and Milius's description of a man who was mentally ill. While Stone at least says it more kindly and without mockery, Milius laughed about Howard's struggles as described in the story. I just want to say that this was a different time. But to move on with the story, Milius says that Howard himself claims that he was alone one night in his boarded up house with his rifles and feels a shadow overtake him from behind. And he knows that Conan is standing behind him. And Conan just stood there with a great axe and told Howard to just stay there and write. And if he didn't do exactly as he said, he was going to cleave him down the middle. Howard was terrified as Conan just exudes power and fear, and he could see that axe glinting in his peripheral vision. So Howard did as he was told, working through the whole night. But when he turned around at dawn, Conan was gone. Howard fell to the floor, totally spent, and said to himself that he could only sleep for a couple of hours because he has to fortify himself for when darkness comes again. Because with the darkness, so will come Conan. And of course, Conan did. It turns out that Robert Howard wrote two of his Conan stories during a period of less than a month under the duress of Conan's threatening acts, with a third story to come a few days afterwards. The first was a rewrite of his last Cole story by This Axe I Rule, with Conan instead of Cole. He removed an entire romantic subplot and created a new one with a supernatural element and retitled it The Phoenix on the Sword, after the new supernatural element in his new subplot. But Howard did not stop there. He went on to write two more new stories about Conan. The first of which was a play on the Greek myth about Apollo and Daphne, set in Conan's early life, called The Frost Giant's Daughter. The last of the initial three stories was The God and the Bowl, which, unlike the first two stories, had to go through three drafts before it was acceptable, and was at a much slower pace than the first two stories. The God and the Bowl was a murder mystery about corrupt officials and serves to show that while Conan's first interaction with civilization, he is actually a better and more civilized person than those who represent civilized society. But as you have read these stories, I think we're going to need your input on all of this, Steve.
Oh, absolutely. Keep in mind, I've read a good cross-section of Conan, though I haven't read absolutely everything featuring him. I'm also not that deeply familiar with King Khal of Atlantis beyond the basic mythos and the fact that Thulsa Doom was Khal's enemy as much as he was Conan's. I will say that the Howard stories are extremely accessible, and you can read them in just about any order and get what Conan is about. As for Robert Howard himself, I think the description he gave is sadly on the money. I do think it's fair to say that he probably did struggle with serious mental illness. He didn't live an overly happy life, and I don't think he ever felt like he truly fit in anywhere. He was an imaginative person living in a time and a place that didn't place any value on Howard's kind of creativity, and I think he struggled with that. Howard could be sullen and morose, I mean, much like Conan himself often was. And I think it's likely that Howard struggled with severe depression during his life, though I can't say so with absolute certainty, not being a psychiatrist. In fact, after finding out that his TB-afflicted mother had fallen into a coma, Howard tragically went out and took his own life. His life is a very, very sad story, and I think it shows that even the best of writers can struggle with deep inner demons. I'll also add that it shows the importance of getting help for these kind of deep emotional problems, because you don't have to fight these kinds of battles alone the way that Howard did. You don't have to suffer for your art, and there is hope.
That is a tragic story, and even sadder still when you consider that he was only 30 years old when he took his own life. More often than not, the most brilliant creators and artists have deep personal struggles and or illnesses that plague their lives and work as both a source of weakness and fuel for imagination. As you said, Conan's personality could reflect that of Howard's. I would also like to add that I really appreciate how you said that, Steve. You don't have to suffer alone these days. There are lots of ways to reach out and ways to get help. And I want to encourage any listener that might need to hear this, that no matter how big something may seem, no matter how eternal it looks, like all things good and bad, it will pass. But that said, let's get back to Conan.
Oh, sure. Let's start with the stories that Howard wrote during his life. And you mentioned some of them, but the core of these stories is Conan of Cimmeria himself and the numerous adventures that he'd be involved in at various points of his life. It's in many ways a rags-to-riches story, with Conan going from slave to wanderer to thief to pirate to soldier. Eventually becomes king of the country of Aquilonia, which was an analog of ancient Rome. The various stories are just little small adventures that happen in the middle of this grand life of adventure and destiny. My understanding is that Howard's influences from Conan came from living in rural Texas and imagining barbarians roaming across the plains. And honestly, having lived in Texas for a very long time, I can tell you that the air is very good for inspiring those kinds of stories. Howard came up with the idea of Cimmeria during a trip to Fredericksburg, Texas, and then he wrote a poem called Cimmeria not long after that. From there, the Conan character grew out of his thinking about the land of Cimmeria. It is true that Howard described Conan as a character that grew out of his head, as he said to Clark Ashton Smith, but it took 9 months for Howard to develop Conan fully as a character during that period. From there, he built the world of the Hyborian Age, borrowing elements from real history and twisting it into a world magic, which is absolutely a valid way of building a fantasy world. I mean, George R. R. Martin took a similar approach to Westeros, I mean, which I call the War of the Roses with Dragons. And Martin definitely read a lot of Howard. I think it's safe to say that Howard became a blueprint for the many fantasy writers that would follow him. So let's talk about the stories that you mentioned. The Phoenix on the Sword is an important story for one major reason. This is the story that introduced the Stygian mage Thothamon, who is generally regarded as Conan's arch enemy. And honestly, I think Thothamon is in many ways the perfect Conan villain because he embodies the evils of civilization. He's ambitious, he's scheming and manipulative, he's a liar, a betrayer, and a user. And he utterly rejects the sense of honor that Conan values. The story itself is a bit unpolished, but the character conflict is really good. Honestly, anytime Conan faces Thothamon, odds are you'll get something good out of it.
That makes perfect sense, actually. Howard really defined the barbarian archetype as someone outside of civilization. And oftentimes, when he runs into trouble, it's when he's interacting with civilization. One thing that I really appreciated about Conan, and the reason he was the basis for my D&D barbarian character, Bjorn, was that he has a code that he follows, and he's not a dumb brute, but is in fact rather intelligent. Brains and bronze is a combination I like a lot.
I can buy that, and I can totally see Conan and Bjorn since you mentioned it. I mean, Conan is the blueprint for the whole barbarian hero archetype, so it's hard not to draw on that. I mean, and Howard perfected it out of the gate. But speaking of Norse-themed barbarian stories, The Frost Giant's Daughter is an interesting one because that's a story that gets adapted in the comics from time to time. It's also interesting because while it's based in Greek myth, Howard twists it by disguising it with Norse elements. Conan is traveling in Nordheim with a party of Aesir raiders, think Norsemen, and they stumble on Atali, who is the Frost Giant's daughter, and her two Frost Giant brothers. Conan kills them, and right as he is about to advance on Atali, her father teleports her away, and Conan at first wonders if he dreamed the whole thing, until he realizes that he has Atali's veil that he grabbed during the encounter. It's a pretty decent story, especially for early Howard. I think you described the God and the Bull pretty well, so I'll turn my attention to one I really like, and that's the Tower of the Elephant. This one takes place during Conan's thieving days, and he has to climb into a sorcerer's tower to steal a jewel called the Heart of the Elephant. Conan runs into another thief called Taras, who is there after the same thing, and the two of them agree to team up. They reach the evil wizard's treasure vault. Taras gets killed by a giant spider, and then Conan kills the creature in revenge. But the twist is interesting. The wizard is keeping a pre-cataclysmic being prisoner and torturing him. The Heart of the Elephant actually belongs to the prisoner, and it's a powerful item of magic. Conan, disliking the idea of anyone in chains because he was a former slave, gives the gem to the prisoner, who escapes and kills the wizard. Conan leaves with nothing, but he's content with this because he did the honorable thing. I like the story as a lot, as it hits Conan's character well, but it also has that feeling of a classic dungeon crawl. It's a lot of fun to read. Also, the stories featuring Conan and the pirate Balit are really good and worth talking about. This takes place during Conan's day as a pirate and a reaver, and he gets mixed up with a pirate queen, Balit, who is the queen of the Black Coast. Conan is sailing with an old friend of his, and they get boarded by Balit and her raiders. But Balit becomes interested in Conan, seeing his bravery and sheer savagery, and she offers to give Conan a place at her side. Conan accepts this offer, and they pillage their way across the seas together, and Balit eventually becomes one of Conan's great loves. But it doesn't last, as Conan and Balit find a lost treasure that happens to be cursed. This leads Balit to her doom at the hands of a monster, and Conan avenges her with a stroke of his blade. He lays her to rest with a Viking funeral, but her death seriously affects him for years after this. Howard didn't live to complete his Conan stories, and there are a number of unfinished ones he didn't get around to doing. But those stories have been finished up by other authors, primarily Lynn Carter and L. Sprague de Camp. But there are other stories that have been adapted and polished in other formats. I mean, mainly the comics. So we'll get into those next. Mike, did you ever read any of the Conan comics?
I'll be honest. I have not read any of the Conan comics. I mean, other than the research I did for this episode, all my Conan knowledge comes from the films and the art of Frank Frazetta.
I can totally get that. I mean, it took a while to get into them myself, I have to admit. My reading of the Conan comics is not comprehensive. but I'm familiar with some of the major developments in the characters, so we'll talk about those. Now, my understanding is that Conan was first brought into comics by in 1972 by Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith, who was then credited as Barry Smith. While these are good, fun, pulpy comics, and Windsor Smith does a decent job on the art, this is very early Windsor Smith before he adopted his signature style. So it's going to look unpolished compared to his later work on things like X-Men or Rune, but it's still good stuff for all of that. But even though Thomas spends much of his run adapting classic Howard stories, and he does well at it, you get some interesting things here and there. One of my favorite early Thomas Windsor Smith stories features the one and only crossover between Conan and Elric. Yes, that Elric of Melniboné, the emperor with a sword that steals, that drinks souls. It's absolutely actually a really cool story where Conan and Elric fight each other for a little while before the real villain shows up. And that villain is Elric's nemesis, Prince Gaynor the Damned. And it leads to some pretty fun classic fantasy adventure stuff. Moorcock was on board with the crossover, and he was even involved with plotting the story somewhat. This story's been reprinted a few times with the old Thomas collections, and I think you'll find it in the Conan Epic collections that have been released in the last few years. I'm guessing Michael Moorcock is getting his royalties from Marvel on that one.
Wow, that last story sounds really badass. It's funny how many swords there are that hold or consume souls, but I love them all that I'm aware of, and I would have loved to see Conan and Elric fight in that in the comics.
Oh, it is an epic meeting for sure. Speaking of spinoff characters, since we're probably going to talk a bit about her movie, I want to mention probably the biggest spinoff from the Conan comics, kind of. And that character is Red Sonja, the warrior princess of Hyrcania, otherwise known as the She-Devil with a Sword. Her creative origins are a bit complicated, it turns out. Red Sonja is actually based loosely on a Robert Howard character named Red Sonja with a Y of Rogatino. This version appeared in a story called Shadow of the Vulture, and it's not too bad if you're interested in the character. Sonja is a 6th century adventuress of Polish-Ukrainian origin who is trying to avenge her sister, a harem girl in the Ottoman court. But the interesting thing about this version of Sonja is that she's not a swordswoman or a barbarian. Instead, she's a gunslinger who uses modern weapons. Roy Thomas knew that story, but he mainly drew on a first few surface elements from Sonja of Rogatino. Mainly the name, the red hair, and the fiery temper. Everything else was transplanted into a new barbarian character who would inhabit Conan's world, and that is how Red Sonja with a J was born. But Red Sonja is easily the most recognizable warrior woman in fantasy literature even today. I mean, she wasn't the first one. I think C.L. Moore's Jor-El of Joiry predated Sonja by several decades, but Sonja's the most iconic of the chicks in chainmail set. And even today, she's probably what most people think of when talking about barbarian fantasy heroines. She's since been off into her own comics. And even today, I'd say Red Sonja is one of the biggest characters that Dynamite Comics has as a stable. Mike, did you have any thoughts about Sonja the Red?
Oh, I certainly do. I freaking love Red Sonja. Although I prefer the version not wearing a chainmail bikini. I'm not a Red Sonja expert, but in my opinion, Red Sonja would be smarter than that and know that there's a lot more to protect than one's crotch and boobs and would likely not dress to attract men. Looking sexy is not a consideration in Red Sonja's mind, at least according to my perception of her, which I'll admit comes mostly from the movie. But I have read some of those Dynamite comics, and the stories and adventures are all good. But I have the same complaint about a warrior thinking sexy first and practicality or defense second. I see Red Sonja as a strong, powerful, and capable woman, but also as a proud woman. Not that I'm suggesting that she could never have a relationship with a man, but only if it did not conflict with her duty or her mission. But, you know, maybe I'm full of shit.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I have to admit, I'm personally a bit conflicted on the bikini. Like, I totally get your point on it not being practical, and I totally agree with that. I can't imagine that the chainmail is comfortable for a woman to wear either. At the same time, I don't think anybody's come up with a more practical look for Sonja that's as iconic or memorable looking as the classic version, and many great artists have tried. I mean, maybe someday we'll get a design that works visually while also being more forward-thinking with the character, but I think Sonja overcomes that problem by being generally a well-written character at her best. She has this fiery and very primal character, and she refuses to bow to anyone. And I love that about her. The Gail Simone run, I think, comes to mind immediately as being really good in grasping those elements. But let's move back to Conan. After Barry Windsor Smith leaves the book, his successor honestly raised the bar on Conan comics. And that was John Buscema, who we've talked about briefly during his time on the Avengers. I love Windsor Smith, especially in his later years, but I feel like Buscema was better for Conan in the long run. I feel like he grasped the grim, sullen look of Conan, and he captured the flavor of the Hyborian Age in a way few artists have before or since. He grasped the historical influences that Howard was working with. He knew how to draw the numerous women that Conan would become involved with and make them all look different. Buscema, honestly, is probably my favorite artist to draw Conan in comics, although I would agree that Frank Frazetta is probably the definitive Conan artist in general. But to wrap up the Marvel run on Conan, aside from Sonya, I think the most interesting characters from the Marvel books that I've read are the villains. I think the biggest villain to emerge was Kulan Goth, who is probably best known for fighting modern-day Marvel heroes, enough. Goth is an evil mage, and he has a typical MO. He wants to turn the modern world into the Hyborian Age. This guy literally cannot let go of the past, so he uses evil magic to restore his glory days. I firstly encountered him in a two-part story featuring the X-Men, but he's also faced the Avengers a few times as well, including once during Busick and Perez's run. But I think he's gradually become more known as a Ren Sonja villain these days, especially after Marvel lost the rights to Conan for a while and he started showing up there. I like Kulan Goth quite a bit, as he embodies this old man who hates change and wants everything to be like it was in his youth. Another villain that I discovered some years ago is a demonic being called Ra'll the Devourer of Souls. He's awesome and honestly frightening. He's an ancient demon who's thousands of years old. He knew Thulsa Doom, who in the comics was an ancient lich from Atlantis. So he's been around a very long time. But Ra'll's signature move is turning living beings into slugs, who he puts in his mouth and he swallows whole, and he eats their souls along with their physical selves. This is in addition to being a 10-foot demon warrior with a massive sword and who's also a devious planner. The only reason Conan survived an encounter with this monster is that Ra'll has a hard time consuming the souls of heroic and strong-willed beings like Conan. As it is, Conan usually barely came out of his fights with Ra'll in one piece. The Devourer is just a fiend of unimaginable power, and he gave Conan a rough fight every single time they fought. I would like to see this Devourer try to give Conan a rematch someday, but he's such a fun villain that I hate to see him be done badly, so it may just as well be just as well that he hasn't come back.
Hot damn. Ra'll sounds awesome, and I would love to read those stories. I mean, you had me at the Devourer of Souls and being an ancient demon. Then you tie that to Thulsa Doom, who was a lich from Atlantis, and I'm straight drooling over here.
Oh, I know what you mean. Unfortunately, the good times didn't last. Around the late 90s and early 2000s, Marvel lost the rights to Conan, and they stopped publishing the Conan books. Which is just as well, because Conan was losing steam by then, and Marvel was trying to get out of bankruptcy. But this led into a really good time for Conan comics and put the character back on the map for a while. Dark Horse picked up the Conan rights, and they also got a great team to do the book. Kurt Busiek and Kerry Nord, who at that time was best known for Daredevil. Kurt Busiek by this time was a little bit past his glory days at Marvel, but his craft hadn't suffered at all. And in fact, I'd consider Conan to be among the best of Busiek's post-Marvel books that is not Astro City. It's a book to fit in perfectly, since Busiek is extremely well-read on Howard and in general, and he also was steeped in the 70s Rory Thomas books. That very much shows. You'll get adaptation of classic stories like The Frost Giant's Daughter, mixed with interesting stories like Conan going to Hyperborea and finding lost civilizations there. I'll also add that Nord's art by this time is absolutely stunning, and much better than anything I'd seen from him previously, including Daredevil. But I think the most significant idea that Kurt Busiek brought to the table came in a story called Born on a Battlefield. This is a short origin retelling showing how Conan was as a young tribesman and how he started off on his own. But I think the idea that Conan was born in a war zone, that everything Conan is defined by constant battle, makes perfect sense. Even by the standards of other Sumerians, Conan is at heart a warrior, and he craves battle and glory. As an aside, I'm convinced that this story was an influence on the Jason Momoa Conan film, too.
I have to say that literally being born on a battlefield during a war is very metal and just screams barbarian. I mean, I've heard the expression born of war, but goddamn, that has taken it literally, and I love it. I'm going to talk about that scene from 2011 Conan the Barbarian in a bit when we get to the Conan films, but I just had to say that.
Understandable. It is a very death metal barbarian moment for sure. The Dark Horse period had some good stuff after that, though I hadn't read that much of it. I mean, Tim Truman took over for Kurt Busiek after he left the book, and I admit that was a solid choice. I mean, towards the end of the Dark Horse run, I mean, Conan went back to piracy with Brian Wood's run, and that was fun for a while, too. They do an adaptation of Queen of the Black Coast with very small pirate adventures here and there in the middle of it. It wears thin after going for a bit too long, but after a while, it was a fun pirate adventure with a side of romance between Conan and Belit. And then a few years ago, Marvel got the rights of Conan back. I think the return of Conan to Marvel was pretty good for a while. The Jason Aaron and Mahmoud Asrar run on Conan gets pretty good, with a story that ties together various strands of Conan's history. I even liked the first few issues of Savage Sword of Conan, where you get some really nice art by Ron Garney. I felt like there were some good Hyborian-style actions in those titles, and they got the energy of what Conan was about. I also think that the Marvel reacquisition was also generally good for Conan's library, since it meant that we would get new reprints of the Marvel Conan stories. We've seen some epic collections of the classic Conan run since the acquisition, and I think that's good for fans of the character, so hopefully we'll gradually see more of those. The one regret I have about Conan coming back to Marvel is that Marvel seems to want to take him out of the Hyborian Age and have him interact with Marvel characters all the time. Now, to be fair, that's not inherently a bad idea, if done sparingly and in a way that works for Conan. But I think they've sometimes overdone it, and I think that means Conan is spending less time in the Hyborian Age. And really, that Conan works best in the world of the Hyborian Age, where he's really allowed to cut loose and be in the kinds of brutal, unforgiving stories that suit him best. So, Mike, how do you generally like your Conan? Should he be in the world of ancient Sumeria, or do you think there's a place for him in present-day superhero comics?
I have to say that Conan would be very out of place when anywhere but the Hyborian Age. And while I'm not suggesting that he should, if he interacts with Marvel characters at all, it should be because Marvel characters went back in time to the Hyborian Age and never because Conan came out of it. Conan is a sword and sorcery fantasy character and should not be in any other setting.
Yeah, I think we're generally in agreement on this one. The occasional fish out of water story with Conan in the present is fine, but it really shouldn't be to the point where Conan is a regular on superhero teams. The idea of present-day heroes time-traveling to the Hyborian Age could be really cool, though. Imagine the Fantastic Four taking Doom Time Machine for a spin and ending up in the Age of Conan, especially Reed Richards, who absolutely hates magic. So, yeah, you could definitely get some promising stories that way, but I digress.
Now that you mention it, that FF story could be cool. But let's talk about my real love when it comes to Conan, and that's the films. Particularly, I want to discuss my favorite among them, the 1982 classic Conan the Barbarian, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Earl Jones. Conan the Barbarian was directed by John Milius and written by Milius and Oliver Stone. But while it came out in 1982, it had been a long time coming, since 1970, in fact. Executive producer Edward R. Pressman and associate producer Edward Summer made an earnest effort to get the film made by 1975. One of the biggest initial hang-ups was getting the rights to make the film. It took a full 2 years to do that, leaving them only 3 years to meet their projection. Pressman and Summer immediately brought on Arnold Schwarzenegger to play Conan because, well, who else could have done it at that point but the man who won Mr. Olympia 7 times and Mr. Universe 5 times. Conan is described as enormous and very, very strong, and you have to have Arnold for that unless you're playing the Hulk. Then you go for Lou Ferrigno. But seriously, after bringing on Arnold, they had Oliver Stone write the first script. However, despite being the executive producer, Edward Pressman didn't have the capital to make the film, since all of his investment proposals to the studios fell through. So in 1979, Pressman sold the project to Dino De Laurentiis, and his daughter Raffaella produced the film. John Milius was brought on to direct the film and to rewrite Oliver Stone's script. Milius's screenplay integrated scenes from Howard's stories and from the Japanese film Seven Samurai from 1954 and Kwaidan from 1965. They filmed Conan the Barbarian in Spain around Madrid and the provinces of Almeria over a period of 5 months. The sets designed by Ron Cobb were based on Dark Age cultures. They really wanted the sets to feel grounded in history. Another huge influence was, of course, the Conan paintings of the great Frank Rosetta. Director writer John Milius insisted on using practical effects and optical illusions for his special effects, even though optical effects were available at the time. Like a trooper, Schwarzenegger performed most of his own stunts during the film and even got bit by a wolf in the process, as the trained dogs brought on for the scene were clearly not all that trained. In fact, they even attacked their trainer on more than one occasion. But check this out, and this really blew me away. I haven't heard of any other studio spending this much money on props. The two types of swords costing $10,000 each were forged for his character. After the filming, it took over a year to do the editing, in large part because of the ratings board. Apparently, the original cut of the film was so violent that it got an X rating 3 times in a row. And then after a fourth edit, they finally got it down to an R rating. I don't know about you, but I want to see that original ultra-violent cut.
Oh man, I find it amazing that there's a cut of this thing that's even more violent than the one we got. I would definitely be interested in seeing that version if it's still out there somewhere. Find me if you have one. But I feel like John Milius was the key to making this movie work as well as it does. My understanding is that Milius had a deep understanding of the military side of things. He hadn't served. He tried to enlist but was rejected, but it was a subject he had a deep interest in. In fact, Milius would go on to write Apocalypse Now, and that film really got Vietnam, even if it's very surreal and bizarre film. But I think Milius got the world of Conan down well because of that, drawing a lot on Howard's idea of historical authenticity. To be honest, even though Arnold's Conan isn't really Howard's Conan exactly, the world Milius built for him is very Howard.
I gotta say, it kind of bumps me out a little that Arnold's version isn't like Howard's. Arnold's Conan is what made me love the character, but c'est la vie, I guess. So let's get into the story. The basic synopsis of the Conan the Barbarian would go something like this. Through the history of mankind, the times that are most recorded in mythology and song are those of great deeds and fantastic adventures. Such a time was the Hyborian Age. Between the time when the oceans drank Atlantis and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of. And unto this, Conan, destined to wear the jeweled crown of Aquilonia upon a troubled brow. Such a tale is the story of Conan the Barbarian. Conan, as a young boy, is living among his relatively unknown people, the Sumerians, and his father tells him about the riddle of steel and forges a great sword that will one day belong to Conan. Now, knowing that the Sumerians in the Hyborian Age of Conan are descendants of Atlanteans, I can't help but wonder if there is some validity to the claim that this sword was Atlantean by design. I have heard it referred to as the Atlantean swords, but we can tackle that in a minute. Back to the story synopsis. After the sword was made and his father tells Conan of the riddle of steel, Conan's people and family are murdered by Thulsa Doom, the head of the snake cult Set, and his veneer soldiers. Conan is captured and taken into slavery for 15 years. He lived in agony, first chained to the wheel of pain, grinding grain, and then enslaved as a pit fighter. But in those years, Conan becomes very strong and hard and develops an indomitable spirit. Freed miraculously one day by his owner, Conan, with his companions, Subutai, the Mongol, and Valeria, Queen of the Thieves, sets forth upon his quest to learn the riddle of steel, which his father has prophesied will confer ultimate power, and to kill the arch villain Thulsa Doom for murdering his family and people.
Now, that opening with a narration by the late great Mako is epic, and I still quote it periodically. So much of that is in Mako's delivery of those lines. Now, I will say that those lines are an abridged and altered version of Howard's. All of that came from the Nemedian Chronicles, which comes straight out of the Phoenix on the Sword. So I'll go ahead and give you the full quote. Know, O prince, that between the years when the oceans drank Atlantis and the gleaming cities, and the years of the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of, when shining kingdoms lay spread across the world like blue mantles beneath the stars. Nemedia, Ophir, Brythunia, Hyperborea, Zamora with its dark-haired women and towers of spider-haunted mystery, Zingara with its chivalry, Koth that bordered on the castoral lands of Shem, Stygia with its shadow-guarded tombs, Hyrcania, whose riders wore steel and silk and gold. But the proudest kingdom of the world was Aquilonia, reigning supreme in the dreaming west. Hither came Conan the Cimmerian, black-haired, sullen-eyed, sword in hand, a thief, a reaver, a slayer, with gigantic melancholies and gigantic mirth, to tread the jewel thrones of the earth under his sandaled feet. I don't know about you, but I appreciate those kinds of details in this film. You definitely get the sense that Milius had read Howard and understood what he was going for. There's the feeling that you're watching this epic fold about a man who achieved greatness in his lifetime, and that the story we're getting will be epic as well. All of this stuff sets the tone perfectly. I'm also going to add that the Riddle Seal was an invention of this film, and as far as I know, was never in the books. It definitely works for this movie, despite that, though. I'm not sure about the origin of the sword myself, I must admit. Probably the Sumerians did remember their knowledge of making steel from the Atlanteans, but there's not much in the film to make that clear either way.
Fair enough. And it would seem that Milius did have respect for the source material, especially with that opening, like you said. But if we could talk about the beginning of the film for a minute. I have to say that I'm a little confused as to what happened between Thulsa Doom and Conan's mother at the beginning of the film. Thulsa Doom's men make this big show out of bringing out his new sword, which he has taken from Conan's father after he was eaten by dogs, and is the same sword we saw them making at the beginning of the film when his father told him the riddle of steel, which I'll get into in a minute. But the sword Conan's father made has to be brought up from the back. Then it is handed to a man who gives it to who I took to be the commander, but is actually a high priest. The commander unsheathes the sword and points it at Conan's mother. You'd think that the commander was going to kill her, but he just hands the sword over to Thulsa Doom, who then again makes a big show out of taking the sword out and looking at his bloodstained blade. But Thulsa Doom does not walk up with the sword ready to fight. He just stands there with it staring at her. The woman goes from a brave fighting stance with her sword held high to dropping it to her side. Now, all of this leads me to believe that Thulsa Doom knows the sword's history or the culture of the Sumerians, and he believes that merely showing that he now possesses it will inspire surrender. And it looks like that's what happens. But then he decapitates her with the sword. That just didn't make sense to me. My thought is, I mean, why make a big show it didn't make any sense. Why make a big show out of all of that just to kill her? I mean, she was already terrified. And if it was about building a reputation, then killing all of the otherwise unknown people did nothing to build that reputation, especially if you take the only survivors as prisoners. I mean, who the hell are they going to tell? In fact, the only thing I can glean from that is that even if you surrender, he will kill you and will apparently make a big production out of getting you surrendered like a big old fucking drama queen.
I'll be honest. I mean, my first thought on seeing that scene again was me yelling at the screen, because here's my question. Why are you not running and taking Conan with you? You'd think that most mothers in that situation would prioritize making sure that her kid was out of danger. Hiding made some sense early on, I mean, to be fair. But then they leave cover, and then the mother just stands there, even though they have every opportunity to run while the bad guys are busy killing everyone. That makes no sense to me either. As to what happens to her, I mean, I think that Khulsa Doom casts some kind of enchantment spell on her to make her drop the sword. It's the only thing I can think of. If I were to guess, they're playing on the idea that he's a snake cultist, and so he has the ability to hypnotize people like a snake. But yeah, I don't get killing her either, especially if you then decide you want to take Conan as a slave. I mean, unpleasant as the idea is, I mean, Conan's mother probably would have had a lot more value if your goal is to take slaves. She probably got off easy by dying right there when you stop and think about it. But really, I think the problem is that they needed to set up Conan's desire to avenge his parents as a motivation, so they had to both die in front of him. Conan's father dies in a way that makes sense and it works, but I feel that Conan's mother could have been dealt with in a more believable way. This film has very few real problems, but this is one of them. finally, I'll add that Thulsa Doom was probably supposed to be Thothamon, but they used an old cult villain as the big bad instead. Thothamon is also a mage and a priest of Set, and as we've established, the filmmakers had read The Phoenix on the Sword, so I'm guessing that the Thulsa we see is something of a mixture of Thulsa and Thothamon, with Thulsa as the ancient sorcerer who uses some of Thothamon's gimmicks.
That's interesting, and I'll have to consider that the next time I watch it. That actually makes a lot of sense. So back to the Riddle of Steel. In the beginning, we see Conan's father making a sword as Conan and his mother look on. And then Conan's father tells the story from Sumerian lore of how the giant kings fooled Crom, who is the ruler of Valhalla on the mountain in Hyboria, and took the Enigma of Steel, the secrets of forging, from amidst the darkness and chaos. Crom raged, and fire came down from the sky, throwing the giants into the sea. But in his rage, Crom forgot the Riddle of Steel, and it was left in the field and later discovered by man. Conan's father tells him that he must learn for himself the Riddle of Steel. The sword that Conan's father made has "Suffer no guilt, ye who wield this in the name of Crom," written on its blade, which is a clue, I think, especially when you add to that the hint Conan's father tells him, which was that you cannot trust anything in the world except for one thing. And showing him the sword of steel he had just forged, he says, this you can trust. By this, he seems to mean more than just how to forge the sword. The Enigma of Steel seems to be describing a path of life, much like a high adventure version of the meditations of a monk discovering both the ultimate question and the answer for it. In the case of the Riddle of Steel, I think the answer is layered. When Conan finds that sword in the cave, and he takes it from what appears to be a long dead king, but afterwards he takes the sword, he cleans it up, and he looks back at the bones of the king, which have now toppled over after the removal of the sword, and he says Crom, and then bows his head against the sword and prays. At least I'm assuming that's what he's doing. I took this finding of the sword symbolically, in the sense that Conan had been forged into a sword of steel by living as a slave and pushing that wheel, and it made him strong through the cold and heat of the seasons. Then he was made a great weapon by his time in the fighting pits, and not just any weapon, a great weapon. His victories were not easy to count. I believe that Conan recognized that Crom in the Way of Steel had been guiding his path through it all, and through his hardship and struggles, he had learned that great lesson of what is truly valuable. This, I believe, was lesson one from the Riddle of Steel.
Yeah, I think the idea of this lesson is that you can't trust people, but you can trust a well-made weapon and your own ability to use it. And most importantly, you can trust your own strength. It's kind of like Han Solo's philosophy. Hokey religions and ancient weapons are no master or good blaster at your side, kid. The religion of Crom seems to push self-reliance, because it pushes the idea that no one will come to help you, not even Crom, especially not Crom. So Sumerians believe in helping themselves with whatever tools they have at hand, because a tool or a weapon will always be at your side when you need it. It's a grim and unforgiving philosophy, but it works for a hard group of survivors like the Sumerians.
It really does fit well, and again builds on the perfect barbarian archetype. But it also feeds into the second lesson of the Riddle of Steel, and this one is a two-parter. Conan understands the steel now. This was a big step for him. But the second lesson would come from Thulsa Doom, who claimed that flesh is more powerful than steel, that steel was nothing without the hand that wields it, and true strength is in the flesh. To prove this, he has one of his subjects kill themselves by jumping to their deaths. This flies in the face of Conan's belief in steel, the one thing he believed he could trust. As Conan was beaten and crucified, it was difficult to deny his enemy's words, especially with the vulture coming down to pick at his wounds as he hung there. That, according to writer John Milius, was meant to be a clear sign that Crom had abandoned him. So hanging on the Tree of Woe, I believe Conan re-examined the Riddle of Steel, as his understanding of it had obviously not been complete, or Crom would be with him. But this time he added what he had learned along the way, namely Thulsa Doom's words about the steel being nothing without a hand to wield it. I find it interesting that before, Conan relied solely on his sword up until he was finally rescued from the Tree of Woe. After that, we see Conan really using his brain and planning like a tactician, and even building traps. The point being that he was no longer just a sword or just brute force, but a brain behind that sword. I think this is because of what Doom said about the steel being nothing without the hand that wields it. But then during the skirmish, the unimaginable happens, and the blade of Conan's sword is cut in two. But he does not discard it or let this stop him. In fact, he ends up cutting Thulsa Doom's head off with his broken sword. I believe this was to say that Conan forged his own path by strength and sheer will in defiance of Thulsa Doom claiming to be Conan's father, as Conan would not be who or what he is if it were not for Thulsa Doom. For a moment, Conan doubts himself, but then sees his truth, the riddle of steel, and that it was Conan's indomitable will that brought him to where he was and made him who he is, and that will is stronger than both flesh and steel. This fits in with Nietzsche's description of the will, which can be summarized as self-determination, the concept of actualizing one's will onto oneself or one's surroundings. And that sounds exactly like what Conan ultimately does.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. Again, this comes back to the belief in Crom being a self-reliant form of religion. You can trust in steel and it will be there for you, but having a sword is not the same as knowing how to or when to use it, or having the will to follow through. You can only trust in yourself and your own ability to use the blade because you can't rely on anyone else. Crom only gives you the tools to overcome your enemies, but the rest you have to do on your own. That's a lesson that Conan has to learn, and he does. The prayer to Crom on the mound, I think, alludes to it well. Grunt revenge, and if you do not listen, then to hell with you! Conan is determined to kill these people with or without Crom, and that is such a great Conan moment.
I hadn't picked up on the significance of the words of his prayer. I just thought it sounded badass. But that really is the summation of self-reliance and of self-actualization and fulfillment, i.e. the religion of Crom. From what I can tell of the movie based on Conan's life, is that the question is what matters in life to a Sumerian. In the very beginning of the film, they quote Friedrich Nietzsche in saying, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. Now compare that to his father saying that the only thing he could trust was steel, or maybe a steel sword. And the similarities are pretty obvious. Overcoming adversity makes you stronger, just like steel becomes stronger as it is smashed and beaten and ultimately shaped under the hammer and through fire and ice. And like a steel sword, Conan was hammered on the anvil of life through fire and ice, and ultimately, I think, learned that what has value in life is earned through struggle and hardship. That, I think, is the first lesson of the Riddle of Steel and the description of Conan's character arc in the movie. But his understanding of the concept evolves through the film. At first, he embraces the violence and power of the sword and steel. This is exemplified in his belief that the greatest things in life are to crush your enemies, to see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentations of their women. That is all about power derived from sheer violent force. But that ultimately proves empty because he has not fully realized all of the Riddle of Steel. You'll notice after his initial victory over the Tower of Set, Conan lives his life partying in luxury to the point where he's even too wasted to defend himself or even be awake when his enemies approach. But that lost its luster and made him weak because he ceased to struggle. However, Conan also said, if I die, I have to go before Crom, and he will ask me, what is the Riddle of Steel? If I do not know it, he will cast me out of Valhalla and laugh at me. And I'm not sure which answer Conan will give Crom when he asks him. Will he talk about being forged into a weapon of steel through the hardship and suffering of his life? Or will he tell Crom that he discovered that indomitable will is stronger than both steel and flesh? What's more, does Valeria appearing as a Valkyrie later prove that he has discovered the answer?
That's an interesting question. I think the idea is that Conan starts as someone who only cares about exacting revenge. But then he embraces the lessons of Crom and truly embraces the Sumerial ideals through hardship. He grows stronger through the trials he faces and becomes more capable, truly embracing the principles of self-reliance that Crom teaches. I don't know if the appearance of Valeria connects with that idea, but I think the ending leaves Conan in a stronger place as a character than he was in the beginning. He's struggled greatly on many levels, but he also gained self-knowledge. And he can move beyond revenge now that he's given his family the satisfaction that Thulsa Doom and the Cult of Set have destroyed. So Conan, in a way, is reborn by the end of the movie, able to begin anew and start the next chapter of his life.
All of that totally makes sense. But let me elaborate on why I think Valeria showing up as a Valkyrie at the end was a sign from Crom. I don't know if it's the same in Howard's book, but in the Conan the Barbarian film, Crom, not Odin, is the gatekeeper of Valhalla, which is why Conan has to give the answer for the Riddle of Steel to Crom or be denied entrance into Valhalla. The Valkyrie specifically were responsible for collecting those worthy souls from the battlefield that were going to Valhalla in Norse myth. And I'm assuming that a Valkyrie could not show up to help someone who was not worthy of Valhalla and knew the answers to the Riddle of Steel. But to be fair, they used the lingo of myth, but changed things around. So I could be reading more into this than what is there.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to this for sure either. I think Crom takes on aspects of Odin for the purposes of the film, but I'm not aware of anything from either Howard or the comics regarding this. My guess is that this is Milius taking some license with the mythos, but I could be wrong on that.
That sounds like the case then. So let's get into the second Conan movie, Conan the Destroyer. A synopsis of Conan the Destroyer with a bit of commentary would go like this. Conan and his companion, the thief Malik, are asked by the evil queen Taramis to accompany her niece Jenna to find a magic treasure in the form of a decorated horn that will bring Dagoth, the dreaming god, to life and spell the extinction of mankind. The magic gem Heart of Ahriman must first be retrieved before the horn can be located. Conan and Malik are joined by Bombata, the captain of Taramis's guard. Bombata has secret orders to ensure that Jenna's virginity remains intact so that she will be pure for the sacrifice to Dagoth and to kill Conan once the gem is obtained. If Conan returns with the treasure and the virgin, the queen promises to bring Conan's beloved Valeria back from the dead. On their way, Conan picks up his friend Akiro, the wizard of the mounds, because he knows that the Heart of Ahriman is being held in the castle of a wizard named Thoth Amon. At Princess Jenna's request, Conan frees a bandit warrior named Zula, and feeling indebted to him for freeing her, Zula joins their quest. After retrieving the jewel, the party reaches an ancient temple and acquires the horn. Bombata betrays and abandons Conan and the others, but they all end up back at the castle, and Dagoth is in fact raised. The battle itself is pretty epic, and Conan does eventually defeat the risen dreaming god, but not before Dagoth kills Queen Taramis and Zula kills her high priest. But while everyone else takes a place in Queen Jenna's new kingdom, Conan says he wants his own kingdom and his own queen, and we're once again teased with him eventually acquiring the crown jewel of Aquilonia, which he will wear on a troubled brow. You know the thing they told us about in the first movie? Well, they don't deliver in this one either, which was a huge letdown. But according to John Milius, he originally had a trilogy in mind for the Conan franchise, and each of the films was going to be about something, i.e. have a theme. The first was about raw strength, the second film was about responsibility, and the third film was about was to be about tradition and loyalty, with the idea that people do things because they are larger than themselves.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that Conan the Destroyer probably was not the film that Milius had in mind. There isn't any of the depth in the first film in Destroyer at all. I do think that there was probably some Howard influence in the basic idea. It seems like they took a little bit from A Witch Shall Be Born, especially with the Queen Taramis character, since she was a villain to that story. And to be fair, Sarah Douglas was a great casting choice for her. She does some really great villainesses, like she did with Ursa in the Donner Superman films. But I think that's probably where the similarities end. They just built their own story, threw out what worked for Milius, and just went ahead with what they were going to do anyway. I remember liking Destroyer as a kid when I first watched it. Even today, I think it's possible to enjoy it on a dumb fun level, even if it's nowhere near as good as Barbarian was. I mean, the group Conan travels with is a bunch of companions, especially Grace Jones as Zula. And as an aside, Grace Jones would have been an awesome Storm way back then. Yeah. It does scratch the itch for fun fantasy action if that's what you're looking for, especially if you like adventuring party films, but it doesn't have the moral or philosophical depth that Milius gave the first movie, and that's a shame. I'm not bothered so much about Conan not achieving his destiny in this film as that happens towards the end of his life. Becoming King of Aquilonia is the end of Conan's journey, and Conan goes through a lot of adventures to get there. But I think if you were to have a King Conan Arnold film, you could probably do it now. An older Arnold absolutely could pull that kind of story off. But if a third film had happened, that could have been the story of how Conan takes the throne of Aquilonia, and you could have gotten something great out of that too. But to get back to this film, all in all, I feel like Destroyer is Conan's Temple of Doom, I mean, it's not a bad film for what it is. It's just inferior to the first one. But unlike Indiana Jones, I mean, Destroyer pretty much put an end to the franchise. Well, except for one other film that's kind of an odd installment. I think you wanted to talk about that one, Mike.
I sure do. And I alluded to this earlier. One last film I'd like to bring up before we get into the remake from 2011 is Red Sonja. I have to say that I didn't recognize Bridget Nielsen until I looked her up, and suddenly I was like, wait, Drago's wife is Red Sonja? A character like Conan is clearly in this movie and likely at a later stage in his life. But he goes by Lord Kalidor in the film. Apparently, he was originally intended to be Conan, but the studio that made Red Sonja did not have the rights to the name Conan, and so Lord Kalidor it was. But let me do a synopsis of the film before we discuss this. I'm curious about your thoughts on Lord Kalidor, Steve. So the synopsis would go like this. An evil queen named Gedron, seeking great power for world domination, invades a temple and captures the priestesses guarding the sacred talisman that can only be touched by women, and actually created the world and also has the power to destroy it. However, one of the priestesses of the temple escapes and finds her sister Red Sonja, who is a great warrior, and tells her about Gedron's plans. The talisman's keeper, Lord Kalidor, insists on helping Red Sonja in her quest to put an end to Gedron's wicked plans, but Red Sonja scorns the help of any man, at least until she sees Lord Kalidor's great skill as a warrior. Then she begins to respect him, and they work together to defeat the evil queen. So what do you think about Red Sonja and the pseudo Conan in it, Steve?
I had such a cognitive dissonance about this long time that made it hard for me to get into it. To be fair, I think Bridget Nielsen is a good Red Sonja, and I don't want to take anything from her. And also, the story doesn't seem to be too bad either. At the same time, how in the world do you cast Arnold Schwarzenegger in a Red Sonja movie and have him not be Conan? Right. I know it's obviously a rights problem, and I totally get that. But when you see Arnold on screen in a Conan spinoff film, you're going to see Conan there, whatever you call his character. I cannot get my head around this. It's probably easiest just to pretend he's Conan. Whatever the film calls him, he probably was Conan in earlier drafts of the script anyway.
To my knowledge, he was actually, but the studio just couldn't obtain the rights. However, this would not be the end of Conan on film. So let's get into the remake. I know that a lot of folks have been hating on 2011's Conan the Barbarian, starring Jason Momoa, Ron Perlman, and Rose McGowan. Now, I know you have some stuff you would like to say in defense of the film, Steve, but before we get into that, let me read a synopsis of the film taken from IMDb. Many years ago, sorcerers crafted the Mask of Acheron, and the dark forces of necromancers of Acheron conquered the world. However, the barbarians vanquished Acheron warriors and broke the mask into pieces and divided it among the tribe. One thing that I liked about the remake was that Conan's birth was shown, and it, to my knowledge, reflected Howard's writing, which describes Conan as being born on a battlefield. But back to the synopsis. The barbarian Sumerian village of Chief Corin is attacked by the evil warlord Kalar Zim. Once the last piece of the bone of the Mask of Acheron to resurrect his wife. When his witch daughter Marik finds the hidden piece, he slaughters the villagers, and Corin's son Conan is the only survivor. Conan swears revenge against Kalar Zim. Years later, the warrior Conan is a pirate, and he decides to release slaves from the field. When he is celebrating in a tavern with friends, he sees a thief being chased by a guard, and Conan recognizes him as Lucius, the Kalar Zim soldier that he had cut the nose off of. Conan lets the guards capture him, and once in prison, he forces Lucius to tell him where Kalar Zim by sticking his finger second knuckle deep into the guy's face via the hole left in it by Conan cutting off his nose. That shit was just burly. Meanwhile, Kalar Zim attacks a monastery where Marik believes that a pure blood descendant of Acheron lives. But the monk sends the descendant Tamara back to her homeland. She is chased by Kalar Zim's soldiers, but Conan saves her. Now Conan intends to use Tamara to reach the evil Kalar Zim, and of course he does, fighting all sorts of people and creatures along the way. While this film was a great action movie, it lacked the depth of the original, in my opinion. The Riddle of Steel was totally absent. and that just kind of ruined it for me. But I mean, that was my two cents with the synopsis there, Steve. What did you have to say about the film?
Just as a point of context, it was the Kurt Busiek, Gary Nord, Dark Horse comic that introduced the Born on a Battlefield idea. And it was good to see that on screen. The character we see in the Momoa film is definitely Howard's Conan, though, far more than the Arnold version was. I feel like the film largely gets a bad rap, though. There are flaws towards the end of the movie, for sure. Momoa is absolutely perfectly cast as Conan. He looks and feels like he came out of a Frazetta painting. I felt like the portrayal brought us the Conan from the books, and this version is probably the closest to Howard's Conan that I've ever seen on screen. Unfortunately, I feel like the casual audiences were expecting the Arnold Conan, and they didn't know what to do with this much more hardcore version of the character. The real steal, for example, is the invention of the Milius film, and while I like that addition, you don't see it in either the Howard story or the comics. So you don't see that here either, but since this is more of a Howard-driven version of Conan, I was fine with that not being in this film. In fairness, I will say that the last act of the film probably could have used more polish. I got the feeling there was some Frankenstein drafting going on with the screenplay. The last act just hits a bit different from the first two. It doesn't have the depth of the Milius film, I agree, but then I don't think it was supposed to. The Momoa Conan film is supposed to be pure pulpy Howard Conan, and it was supposed to feel like an adventure that plays out in the style of those stories. On that level, I think it hit the mark decently well, even if it could have been better. But I think Milius changed expectations for a Conan film so much that if you're not steeped in the Howard stuff or the comics, you're probably going to be taken back a bit because this film wasn't done in the Milius style. I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's just a very different one from what a lot of people probably expected.
And I'll admit that as a guy who became a fan with Arnold's Conan, it was a lot different for me. I personally can't unattach the Riddle of Steel and the Religion of Crom. So like you said, it was a lot different than I expected. But that is not to say it was bad. But it probably says something that I own the first two Conan films from 82 and 84 and not the one from 2011. But that finger in the face scene was pretty friggin' awesome, I have to admit. Well, that about wraps up our deep dive into Conan the Barbarian. Thanks for listening. And I want to take this moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us on ORP today. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to please share this episode and help us get the word out.
That is indeed a big help, and we want to thank you in advance for your support of both listening and sharing this episode. It means a lot to us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.